All right, guys. For the weekend here, I've got a really, really fun chat that I had with Jim, James, and Hari from the What Do We Know podcast, which is a just a hilarious bunch of dudes basically just exploring a bunch of different topics that they want to dig into, and they had me on to talk about Bitcoin. And it was just really great get to hear a bunch of outsider questions, because I'm usually into a whole bunch of jargon and crazy deep nonsense into Bitcoin, having been here so long. So this is probably another really good one for new people, and also it was just an absolute blast. So they are releasing this actually in two different parts. So this will be the first piece, and hopefully pretty soon they'll be releasing the second piece. And I will be cross-posting that as well. But if you want to check out the What Do We Know podcast and hear them dig into all sorts of other topics, I have got a redirect set up at guyswan.com/WDWK. What Do We Know? With that, just a really quick thank you to our awesome sponsors for bringing this show to you guys. That is Levvl.co, LVL.co. The full-on Bitcoin banking suite and exchange, and there are no trading fees, and that is just awesome. Again, that is Levvl.co. Then we've got our second sponsor, the Bitbox, the best Bitcoin hardware wallet. For those new to the space, it is literally right in the sweet spot for a secure, minimalist, and just easy-to-use Bitcoin hardware wallet. So if you have got some Bitcoin savings to keep secure, the Bitbox is where it's at. And then lastly, our mobile wallet solution, Hexa Wallet. This is a non-custodial wallet that you're using on your phone to hold your keys. It's got multiple accounts, it's got transaction batching, it's got a seedless backup system, and they are only in beta, so there are tons of more features to come. That is Hexa, Hexa, and you can check out all of our great sponsors at guyswan.com. But without any further delay, let's get into our show with Jim and Hari, the What Do We Know podcast, having a hell of a time talking all about Bitcoin.
Welcome back to another episode of What Do We Know with Hari and Jim. We are here somehow. It's been a long day already, and it's very early in the morning. This is our first morning episode. I'm Jim Flanagan, joined as sporadically by my co-host, the wonderful, funny, beautiful, and talented Hari Rao. Hari, how are you today?
Wow, what an introduction. Thank you very much.
Well, we had a terrible lead up to the introduction, and eventually we just had to start. So I abandoned all format and just went with it. But it's good to speak to you, my friend.
I'm excited because I have this new microphone, as you do. I feel like I sound very sexy.
Yeah, I feel like you sound very sexy. And I think that that's coming through in how you're using that microphone. And I, for one, not a fan. We're going to talk about those mics and some other stuff later, but before we do anything, we need to bring in the third member of this this podcast, our producer at the People of Comedy Studios, James Webb. James!
Hello, boys.
How are you?
I'm so tired. That's how I am.
Believe it.
So, I'm excited, though. I'm ready for this.
We began today's episode, as far as recording, because we have a very special guest, and we wanted to fit it in wherever we could into his schedule. So we are recording on a Sunday morning at 9 a.m., which to normal grown-ups is perfectly acceptable. But to James Webb...
On a Sunday? Come on, bro.
James, I feel like you do something where you do intermittent sleeping, where you like sleep in a coffin like 12 minutes at a time or something,
it's
like as Joe Rogan said it once.
It's not far off.
Okay, I believe that. Okay. Yeah. What is your normal bedtime?
Oh, dude, I go to bed at like 4 or 5 in the morning.
Oh, jeez. Okay. Yeah.
Wow. Hari, you were, you complained to me more about this than James did, which was shocking to me. You were just like, 9 a.m., we were going to watch a movie. That was what he said to me last time. I'm like, first of all, it's 10:30, so you can still do that and wake up at 9 a.m.
Oh, my God.
What time do you go to bed normally?
Oh man, I'm kind of a night owl, to be honest. I mean, my normal bedtime is around midnight. On a Saturday though, I mean, we're pushing 1, 2 maybe.
Do you need your 8? Are you that
Oh
guy?
Yeah. Yeah, as I get older, I find that I need my 8. Like, you know, 10 years ago, 5 or 6 was fine, but I don't know, lately it's like minimum 8, maybe 9, 10.
Oh my god.
Nice.
All right, you sound like you just left a float tank.
I feel like I was going to make that reference. And I was like, nobody's going to remember that.
Of course I would. It's one of our only other like 20 episodes.
I love a cool Hari in the morning.
It is, right? We got cool Hari back. This is great. Your cardigan probably is unbuttoned, isn't it? Hari and I have new microphones. We each went with the Yeti Blue at James Webb's suggestion. I went to the Best Buy yesterday. And I asked a very embarrassing question in the technology section. I don't know what that's called. It's probably more embarrassing than anything else.
I think the whole Best Buy is the technology section.
I call Best Buy the technology section. Yeah. I do. I think it's an extension of Bed Bath & Beyond. It's it's the technology
Bed
section.
Bed Bath & Best Buy.
Exactly. Right. I was like, hey, I knew there was something weird about trying to set up a mic and headphones for my computer, and I couldn't remember exactly what it was. So I asked the guy, first of all, I had him point me to where the Yeti Blue microphones were, and I still grabbed the wrong one at first. But then when I got the right one, when he put that one down and gave me the right one, I was like, I've only got one audio jack, you know, so I can't really plug in the mic and my headphones. Do I need a splitter or something? And he goes, well, this is a USB microphone. And I was like, oh, yeah, that's my problem. My MacBook, I said, throw that in, you know, I'm a Macintosh guy now, only has USB-C on it. Do I need like a, he goes, an adapter. And he goes, you know what? And just doesn't even talk to me. Just like walks to a different section, grabs the adapter I need with me following in tow, like a like a child who just got yelled at. And he just puts it in my hands and walks away without like disgusted by me, by the fact that I could not speak my problem to him.
It's everybody who works at the Best Buy is the IT guy is the thing.
Yeah, basically.
But you got what you needed, right?
I did. How was your experience?
Actually, I have to say that mine was a very positive experience. I went into the technology section and I didn't get an IT guy. I got a cool dude. Who like was totally on board. I was like, yeah, I was reluctant to say, you know, I have this podcast, you know, because I don't know, it just sounds like kind of cliche. Now everybody's got a podcast.
Sure. Wait, he doesn't listen?
So he didn't recognize me immediately when I walked in. I was a little bit offended.
Yeah, that's weird.
But yeah, I wanted to tell, it's like talking to a doctor. You don't just, you got to tell him what's wrong, what you need. So right. I was like, yeah, this is for my podcast. Okay. Just deal with it. And he was like, oh, dude, no problem. He's like, I use the Blue Yeti to when I record music, man. I love it. And he was just so excited. He was like excited for me. It was like he wanted me to enjoy this experience.
Like you were buying it for him for Christmas.
Exactly.
And we're going to have such a good time and we're going to do podcasts and we're just
he has a so nice. Vested interest in this.
Listen, our intro might be a little quick today, but that's because we're excited. We have a great guest on a fantastic subject that I can't believe I haven't even mentioned. We're learning about the crypto economy, baby.
Yeah, baby.
We're going to get some info on the Bitcoins. The reason I think the intro is going to be a little bit shorter, we have a very special guest, too. This is what we in the business call a get. And James Webb used his connections in this outer space money realm get a wonderful guest, a podcaster, and just in the Forbes magazine, a list of best podcasts on Bitcoin with his podcast, Bitcoin Audible. Guy Swan is going to be joining a couple of idiots like us to explain to us how this new money works. Let's take a quick break. We'll be right back. We're going to bring in Guy Swan in just a bit.
Cool.
And And we are back with our guest. We're very excited to introduce Guy Swan. Let's start with our first segment, though. Three questions before we get into Guy. We're going to have him start with three questions for us, a little bit about Bitcoin, which we know absolutely nothing about. Guy, thanks for joining us. Let's start with question number one.
First question is, what was the first thing ever purchased with Bitcoin?
Ooh, what was the first thing ever purchased with Bitcoin? I'm going moon rocks. I feel like it was some weird shit.
Wow, that's a good answer.
There was some weird stuff.
Okay, that's a great question.
Moon rocks is not correct.
Okay, all right. We'll come back to that.
Valiant effort.
Thank you. Good. We'll come back to the answers. That's awesome. Harry, what is your guess on this?
Well, if it's not moon rocks, it's got to be socks.
Socks. Okay,
it's that's be a very pair of socks.
That's a nice pair of wools. Okay, good. We'll come back. Guy, what is question number two?
Okay, question number two is, what makes Bitcoin better than gold?
What makes Bitcoin better than gold? That's fascinating. So I think I have a guess here, and that's the scariest thing. I feel like it was better when I was guessing things like moon rocks. I think it's because there's a finite amount, and I don't know that to be true at all. That's just a thing I heard.
There's a finite amount of gold in the world.
You know what, Harry? All right.
I don't want to get into a whole ores discussion with you. But.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. We don't need to get into the ores discussion today. What is your guess? Because mine's clearly incorrect, as you pointed out very quickly.
I think that, I mean, gold is just like any other physical thing could go out of favor, maybe. Whereas this is a thing that from my very limited understanding, is very secure and probably people would believe in.
All right, I'm going to have a hell of a time recapping that answer later, but we're going to go out of favor and people believe in it. All right, great. And Guy, what about question number three?
Why is the dollar bad money? Why is fiat, we'll just say fiat in general, which is just government-run money, why is that bad money?
The influence of government on the currencies.
Wow. All right, that sounded... official. Good for you. I don't trust any government with my money. I keep it all under the mattress here in the double wide, as you guys know. That's what I like to do.
Smart man.
Thank you. You know, it can't inflate here, you know. So I have no clue on this one. Man, Harry's answer was so smart. I don't even know what's possible. I can't be a better answer or a funnier answer than that. So I'm just going to say, yeah, I'm going to say because of their ability to manipulate it, right? They can create more or less as needed. All right.
So my answer then, basically.
Yeah. Harry's correct. Is what I'm deferring on three.
Defer to Harry.
Hey, thank you for joining us today. We have a very special guest. So as I mentioned at the top of the show, this guy's got a great list of credits. Guy Swan is here we're going to let him tell you a little bit about himself. Guy, we use the term expert very loosely on this show, so please feel no pressure by that. But we do want to know, what makes you an expert in the field of Bitcoin? Why are we talking to you today? Tell us a little bit about you.
Okay. Well, I've been in Bitcoin since I felt like it was me and 100 other people. And I literally just went nose to the grind to learn every damn thing I possibly could about it. So it's going on 9 years and almost like getting close to 10. And I was just utterly fascinated. And specifically, I think I've got a pretty decent proof of work that I am the guy who has read more about Bitcoin than anybody else you know. That's my tagline for the show. But the podcast, Bitcoin Audible, is literally me. Early on, I would try to, I hunted through everything I could find. To just read, you know, the biggest criticisms of Bitcoin, why it was going to die, what its biggest vulnerabilities were, why it was going to the moon, like everything, because it was really sparse. Like, it was really hard to find good writing about it. And I was a huge podcast listener. So I was like, why the hell isn't there audio? Why isn't there audio for all this stuff? I really wish somebody would just read this out loud and then, you know, explain it to me and, you know, do all this stuff. And after like wishing somebody else would do it for about 2.5 years, I finally broke down and just sat down with my iPhone one day
on the bed and just started doing it myself. Awesome. 3 years later, it's a big podcast in the Bitcoin space, and I've got close to just shy of 500 reads now in audio. And good God, I've read 2,000, 3,000 on top of it, just filtering through.
Wow.
So yeah, I've done
that's incredible.
Quite a bit of reading about Bitcoin.
Well, and that podcast, particularly Bitcoin Audible, was recently in Forbes magazine, just stating the size and scope of it. You know, it was one of the top Bitcoin podcasts, and that's incredible. And then on top of that, you also have I don't know much about this one, and I want to kind of get.
It's
okay,
new.
Good. Yeah. I want to get more into some specifics of Bitcoin. But before we do, this one just really struck me. Shitcoin Insider, which I love. Because it feels like from what you're saying, like you didn't just want to look at the good side of Bitcoin. Because it's really easy for everyone telling you it's going up and up and up, just reading James's posts every day about how amazing it is. But you also need that counterbalance, right, of the bad side of it. And does that fit into some of these somehow?
So on occasion, I'll specifically hit some criticisms or like vulnerabilities or how to like think adversarial about Bitcoin on Bitcoin Audible. But Shitcoin Insider was actually just one of the things about like 99% of the rest of the crypto space is it's just chock full of scams and copypasta and nonsense. And I wanted to talk about it on Bitcoin Audible, but it's like not really Bitcoin related, you know?
Yeah.
And so I wanted to have like this little guilty pleasure corner where I could go over and just talk about the disaster and the fork and the minor protest or whatever that just happened, like the whole like network failure that happened on IOTA or Filecoin or some of these other just like total garbage projects, and spend an hour just talking about like everything that broke.
I love it. Just shit posting shit. And, that's hence Shitcoin Insider. That makes Shitcoin tons of
Insider.
Sense.
Yeah. And I got I met somebody in the Bitcoin space who now we're really good friends. But he is a true Bitcoiner who loves to dabble in all the shit coins. So he's constantly like trading on Ethereum and, you know, using the Uniswap and all the mess, but he knows it's all BS, but he just plays with it. Like he just loves to tinker with all of it. So I call him the Shitcoin Insider and my co-host for the show.
That's great. I want to quickly jump back a little bit because I understood five of those words, but I've heard of a few others.
Which five?
mostly the ands and does and things like that.
The articles are the good ones.
Exactly. Really exactly. I'd heard podcasts before. That was a good one. No, but seriously, I have very minimal knowledge on Bitcoin. And Hari is an accountant, so I feel like
Shitcoin sounds like you're describing the inside of my wallet. I feel like
probably is. And Hari is an accountant who doesn't have a ton of insight on Bitcoin. So at the very beginning, can you just kind of cryptocurrency versus Bitcoin? Is Bitcoin a type of crypto? What's the relationship there?
Okay, Bitcoin is the first cryptocurrency. I guess you could say quote unquote cryptocurrency, even though it wasn't really a term, was essentially the goal of the cypherpunks who've been trying to build a system like this for arguably about 30 years prior to Bitcoin. In fact, there were many, many precursors to this. DigiCash, eCash, B-Money, BitGold. And what's funny is a lot of these precursors would figure out one little piece of the puzzle, but then all the other pieces would just have to rely too heavily on one central party, or there'd literally just be a company that had to run the servers, or you know, there was always some sort of a problem with it that allowed it or did not allow it to stand on its own if the people who had created it left, or if the banks said, no, we're not going to use this. There was something that relied on someone else to give it permission to work. And because of that, they all ended up failing. Some of them never really got off the ground. Some of them never even got implemented. Bitcoin is the first that put all those pieces together, and it just exists out there. And anybody can join it, use it, run it, program with it. It is a protocol for money, very much the same way that TCP/IP, the base layer communication layer of the internet, is just a protocol for communication. Anybody can write on it. Anybody can write an app. Anybody can make a website. Anybody can run a Zoom thing. Like, you know, Zoom doesn't have to call up the internet and be like, can we connect? You know, like it's just out there for anybody to run.
I gotta ask a question about that, because that's where the single concept that confuses me the most.
Right.
Because like you said, you know, you don't have to get permission or whatever to use the internet. You can just make a program that runs on it or use it for whatever purpose. People have to accept Bitcoin, right? Like a store has to be like, I'll take Bitcoin. Like, is that not the right way to look at this?
Sure. Same way, if you want to send an email to somebody, they have to set up an email account. Like they have to have their own email. They can run their own email server, like on their computer, but they need to be speaking the same language. In that same way, someone has to be quote unquote speaking Bitcoin, or you need a translator. You need a service like Strike or Cash App or something like that to accept Bitcoin on their behalf so that you can spend it at places, and then they'll forward dollars or euros or yen, you know, whatever on the back end. And you as a user just don't know it. You're just, you know, spending Bitcoin.
So like anything, Bitcoin requires users as a market, basically, right? Like, it requires more people to get involved and to accept it, but for larger success.
Yes. Yeah, it's like it's a network. So it has the same network effect as something like, any communication network, like a phone. You know, if you're the only person in the world with a phone, it's completely useless.
Right.
It might be brand new technology, but the purpose of a phone is to call somebody else. Nobody else has a phone. You can't do anything with it.
Right.
Might be a groundbreaking revolution in technology, but you can't do jack with it.
Exactly.
But if everybody in the world has a phone, then, you know, you pick up a phone and suddenly it's one of the most powerful tools on the planet. And same with like social media. Like, if social media has four people on it, it's not a very valuable social media. But as soon as there are billions of people, it's incredibly valuable. It's referred to as Metcalfe's law, but it's just the number of connections that you can make on the network is the number of users. It's square. Like, the number of users times the number of users is roughly the value of the network as a communications tool.
So,
and Bitcoin and money is the same way.
So, like, I've never, you know, just as the average person, I've never seen anything that I've purchased priced in Bitcoin.
Sure.
Like, how, where does it,
yeah, we're before
where
is that. It, yeah.
Where is it getting its value?
Okay, so this is the key thing to understand, and it requires a bit of digging through monetary history. Is the monetization of an asset takes an extraordinary amount of time. You can find places that will price in sats, which is the tiniest unit of Bitcoin. Like, there's 100 million sats in one Bitcoin, so it's like a really tiny unit, but it's just like cents to the dollar. That you can find places that like accept that, and you can obviously find places that will price things in dollars, but will accept Bitcoin if you wish to pay, and then they just convert, you know, at checkout or whatever. But we are heavily, heavily still in the monetization phase. The network is not there yet. Even the protocol itself cannot handle like the sort of traffic in order to do so. But because it's a scarce asset, because there's only ever going to be 21 million Bitcoin, it's, as the network grows, the only thing that can adjust to account for the new users is its price. So there's a pretty powerful feedback loop in purchasing it early under the assumption that it will be, like, knowing its characteristics and the fact that people will understand its value in the future. If I buy it now before all of those other users get in, well, then I'll actually make profit. I'll actually have higher purchasing power with my Bitcoin as time passes. It's like buying an oil field before people figured out how to turn it into gasoline. You know, people would actually, like, oil's spurting up out of the ground for 30 years there was a horrible, horrible thing. Well, during the 30 years, everything before that, obviously, was always horrible. But if it was popping up out of your ground and you had, you know, acres of land, and suddenly there's oil seeping out of the ground, that was a nightmare. That means you couldn't grow corn on it or wheat or anything. And now you had to, this land that you just spent a whole lot of money on is now trash. You had to give it away, essentially, because nobody wanted it. But if you were the one that realized that, oh my God, this oil stuff is really useful, I'm going to buy this land and start drilling it out, and I'm going to figure out what to do with it, then you could get basically free land that was actually just had a gold mine underneath it, essentially. And that's where we are right now in Bitcoin.
Old Jed's a millionaire.
Definitely. I want to jump into something you just said that took me aback, and I've heard different things on this. There will only be a total of 21 million Bitcoin ever. Can you explain a little bit about what Bitcoin physically is and mining and why there's a limit?
Okay.
That's a lot. I'm sorry. So feel free.
Okay.
Grab some water, take some breaks.
Take some
time. We'll pause your time.
The bathroom.
We'll riff a little bit if you need.
Everybody hang out for a minute.
We'll do what we need to.
Physically what Bitcoin is, it's just it's a file. It's a digital file. And prior to Bitcoin, like if you had a digital file, you could never know that you're the only one that has it, right? Like if I have a picture of use the example of a goat at one point. If I have a picture of a goat, you have no idea if you're the only one with the picture of the goat. It could also be on Google Images, like 10 million people could have downloaded it. If I send it to you, you also have no way to know that I didn't send it to a billion other emails at the exact same time. You can't own that picture. You just have a copy of it. That's true of all digital information. There was never, ever, ever a way before to know you're the only one who has it without just trusting somebody else. Bitcoin solved that problem. It is the first digital thing, which just naturally it was just turned into a point. It's basically an account balance for the owner that you can own, that you can have as a digital thing and know that nobody else has it. It is entirely under your control. And if somebody sent it to you, they did not send it to somebody else. And that's referred to as the double spend problem. And specifically in a adversarial network, a network where you would expect your hackers to log on to as well, and the people who may want to do you harm, or anybody in the world, if it's just an open permissionless network, then all of the worst possible people who want to destroy Bitcoin would also be able to log into it and tinker and do whatever the hell they want, right? It's not asking you who you are and like making sure that you're trustworthy to get on. Like it's just an open protocol. Well, in that sense, Bitcoin solves what's referred to as the Byzantine generals problem, which was actually taught in computer science as an impossible problem for many years prior to Bitcoin's existence, is that if we can't trust, like, how do we reach consensus? How do we know the exact same information about this network? If I can just broadcast that, no, you don't own those Bitcoin, I own those Bitcoin. Or let's say I come in and I just say that there's 21,100,000 Bitcoin because look at my balance over here. Here's an extra 100,000 because it would be really helpful for me if I just had an 100,000 extra Bitcoin. How do we achieve consensus? How do we make sure that everybody knows that 100,000 is fake? And who do we trust? That's the core, like, revolutionary problem that Bitcoin solved, is that everybody knows, essentially everybody in the entire network is a referee. Imagine like Hari is a accountant. Think about it as every single person who runs the Bitcoin software is doing a full top-down audit of the entire system. It's like, so the whole job of a bank is being run by everybody who turns the software on. And essentially, if anybody cheats the rules that those people have downloaded and are checking by, if anybody cheats it, they're just evicted from the network. So you just don't get to play anymore. Imagine if a website tried to hit you with malware or something, like you would just, but you could audit their entire website. You can audit everything that they're doing. Well, you would just identify the malware and you'd be like, okay, well, you're not on the internet anymore. And then they're just on their own network. They can't talk to anybody. And the only way for them to get back on the internet is to delete the malware, play by the proper rules, and then they can reconnect immediately. And now they're all playing again because they've no longer cheated. They've removed the lie from their software. This is that for accounting, for money, for exchange, for ownership. This is a giant banking ledger that nobody owns, essentially.
So has there been no counterfeiting of Bitcoin in its history? I'm sure people have tried, obviously.
Yes, people try all day, every day since Bitcoin has been born.
It's a Bitcoin. Come on, case, it's worth something.
There is one case in.
Can you even do that accent? That way?
I don't know if that was Dracula or if that was.
Let's just go with Dracula.
I'll buy that. That's an easy slide in there. It was good Dracula.
I want to take your Bitcoin.
One, two.
And our sponsor for today is Hexa Wallet. Now, for the people who are new to Bitcoin, holding your keys and using Bitcoin can feel really awkward. And I encourage starting out with a simple mobile wallet. And it's important to be wary of a lot of them in the App Store because not all of them are trustworthy. But it's great to do mobile before you go kind of full life savings mode. And Hexa is just great for this. And they actually give you testnet Bitcoin, so you can send and receive on the testnet so that you can understand how it works and get a feel for it without actually risking your funds. Then on the Bitcoin side of things, they've got multiple accounts, varying degrees of security. They've got a seedless backup and recovery process, easy batching so you can save on fees, and they are in beta, so they're always adding stuff, and they love your feedback. So definitely check out the Hexa mobile wallet. And if you want to learn more, go to guyswan.com/Hexa.
Oh shit, what was I saying?
I lost the question.
Counterfeiting.
Yes, counterfeiting. So there was one case very early on. It was like 2010, I think. So this was after Bitcoin was only a year old. And everything was fresh. I mean, people were still trying to figure out how the hell this thing worked. And there was there's a very common bug in software called an overflow bug. And it's when you basically just, whatever software is doing a check, like is validating or checking on something, that if you just flood it with too much information or basically give it more information than its parameters even allow, that sometimes you can squeeze in information on the end and get it to ignore it. And that's a kind of a dumb explanation, but it kind of fits the analogy.
Oh, yeah.
somebody did that and created like 30 billion Bitcoin or something like that. And it actually got mined. And everybody saw it immediately because everybody's checking the software. Obviously, like the code basically throws up some red flags. And typically, without the overflow bug, anybody could do that at any point on the network. And everybody would just be like, get the F out of here. You suck. But in this particular case, it got included in the chain or in the ledger, like in the banking ledger, as if it was valid. To push an emergency update to essentially roll it back. But because of the rules is that everybody like... Oh, good Lord. I have to explain mining here. This is the complicated. This is what makes it really, really difficult. Intuitive.
No, but mining is a really big piece of it that we need to understand that, right?
At some point, yes. mining solves two purposes. One is that we need to figure out a way to issue Bitcoin. That to issue this new currency, this new money or unit, whatever it is, into the world that's fair, that like isn't controlled by one person. Like we can't just give somebody 21 million Bitcoin and be like, oh, well, you just sell it to everybody else.
Right.
It needs to just be an open participation, an open market. So what Satoshi used was a system that mimics mining for gold. All right. We're just going to run this operation, and every one in 1,000 of these operations, but probability wise, will come up with a very explicit number. It's just like a lottery. You're just rolling dice over and over and over again. And so at some point, you know, when you have 10 dice, if you just keep rolling it and rolling it, at some point you're going to roll 10 ones. But it's going to take a whole lot of rolls.
Right.
Well, when you roll 10 ones, you get rewarded with new Bitcoin. And that's how the Bitcoin is mined into existence. But the beauty of that operation, it's referred to as proof of work, is that it can't be cheated, is that you have to roll the dice. So if you roll, if you end up with 10 ones, which you can prove you got 10 ones in the with this operation, is that you know that nobody did that just on the first roll. You probably rolled like a billion times before you got those 10 ones. And that's referred to as proof of work. The beauty of it is that you can't go backwards in Bitcoin. Like every single time somebody rolls, they're adding a new thing onto the end of the chain. So this ledger is continuing forward in time. But the only way to go backwards in time is to re-roll past everything that somebody's already done. And the entire network is doing this collectively. So if there are a billion computers right now rolling the dice to find the next set of transactions and the next set of Bitcoin and push us into the future, you have to have a computer to go backwards even 10 minutes. You have to have a computer that is more powerful than all billion of those other computers combined that are trying to push us forward. So what it essentially does is it puts a force field around the past. Is that the amount of energy spent moving forward is the exact amount of energy you would need to spend in order to move backward. So the history of Bitcoin, after 10 minutes, you have about $1 million or like $1.5 million worth of guarantee that your transaction is not going anywhere. So if you send $1 million, it's done. Nobody could ever, like, nobody would reverse it because it would cost them almost $2 million to even go back. Whereas after an hour, you've got six times that. After a day, after a few days, we're talking about billions of dollars worth of assurance that your transaction is done. And there's absolutely nothing anybody can do about it. Now go back to the 2010 thing with the bug, is that miners had to, and again, the network is very small. Very few people are doing it. They're working out the kinks and trying to figure out if this thing can actually survive in the wild at this point. And miners essentially had to emergency update to software that was able to recognize when this overflow bug was executed. And then they had to mine for 8 hours to go backwards into the past to undo that transaction. And it was a real crazy, I was actually like there when this happened. And it was one of the most just insane things to like see live, and I'm like watching like my block explorer or whatever. It's like blocks are getting reorged and stuff like that. It was absolutely crazy. It was pretty fascinating to see the consensus mechanism kind of heal itself in a situation like that. Since then, there's been no bug to that extent that was ever exploited.
And I feel like with any type of currency, you're going to have the people trying to counterfeit. Like you said, time, right? Absolutely. And you're going to have errors and issues that can come up too that you certainly have to work around. Mm-hmm. I want to sidetrack us for 1 second because I think there's an important piece of Bitcoin to people who don't have a good understanding. And I don't want you to take this the wrong way because you care tremendously about it and you can tell that you've put a ton of research into it. But there are people who feel like this is a multi-level marketing scheme.
Oh, duh.
What I mean? like it requires, I mean, but everything works this way, right? Like you said, like cell phones, if only one person had it, you know, it wouldn't work. But these, they're correct, but there is also that piece, you know, this seems a lot like how I got into Nexium is all I'm saying, guy. And I want to just know, like what you say to people who are skeptical.
Okay. First off, I would be concerned if that wasn't the first reaction. If you're looking at internet points, you better meet that with skepticism
right
off the bat. And when they call it magic internet money and just scream HODL like all the time, like even doubly more reason to be skeptical. So doesn't surprise me in the least. It's been the normal state of every year, every day that I've been in Bitcoin is people are skeptical, certainly. One thing to consider is the Lindy effect. the longer it scams are usually successful for a very short period of time. Then they blow up. Bitcoin has 20x to 100x in price. Basically, I guess we're on, this will technically be the fourth cycle that that's happened on, and then it has blown up and then recovered. And we are moving into the fourth time. I think anybody before actually looking at it and understanding why, that should be the biggest indication that this isn't just a tulip bubble. That there is something here. Yes, it is very difficult to understand. Yes, it is very unintuitive or counterintuitive, really. But there is something worth looking into. It'll take a while to get there. There's a lot of reasons why it's not. Probably the simplest thing to hit is that it's solved a couple of incredibly profound computer science problems. There's a great piece by one of the forefathers of Bitcoin, as you would say, the cypherpunks who had been trying to build a system like this for a very long time. He's actually the guy who created BitGold, which is one of the concepts prior to Bitcoin that I would argue is the closest to Bitcoin. The guy's name is Nick Szabo, and he wrote this piece called The Dawn of Trustworthy Computing. And I got it in audio on my show. And it's about creating computer systems where you don't have to trust anyone in it, because the computer system itself knows how to tell the difference between an honest player and a cheat. We don't have that anywhere else. Hmm. There's absolutely nothing in the normal ass world that can do that. The only mechanisms we have are to just trust somebody higher up the ladder. You can't do that decentralized. You can't, without a police officer, without a president, without an owner or a top-down person that's looking down on everybody who basically has a master key. So we're trusting them not to cheat, even though they have the full power to do so. And then they're watching everybody else and saying who is a cheater and who isn't. But it also means that technically they get to pick who gets to cheat and who doesn't. That's how it works in human world. And computers were no different. Computers were just a way to log into somebody else's machine somewhere else for the longest time. This is what we refer to as the dawn of trustworthy computing, where we build a protocol that doesn't care, that has nobody in charge, that has no president, that has no bank owner that's picking winners and losers and cheaters and people who can cheat and people who can't cheat. It's where the network itself knows the difference between a cheater and an honest player, and it only lets honest players in.
I wanted to ask about where we are in the development of Bitcoin as just being a, you know, a widely accepted type of currency, because we're not there yet where you just go into like Best Buy and you can, nope, you know, buy a Blue Yeti microphone with X amount of Bitcoin. You still got to use dollars and cents.
There are some services where you can actually get around that little problem, but certainly Best Buy is not accepting it, and certainly we can't do it at a global scale yet.
Is the value behind it on the expectation that this will be such a wide, like it's the currency of the future?
I'll say yes and no, because it's not merely that we'll get to use it as a currency.
Okay.
It's also the assurances that you own it. And right now, it can provide those assurances uncontested. Like, there's nothing in the world that you can own as surely as you can own Bitcoin. Like, in the context of, like, a house, your jurisdiction has to say you own the house. You know, if the president signs a thing and shows it to everybody, you look, I did a thing. It's like, your house doesn't belong to you anymore. It belongs to us because we need it for A, B, and C. The judge says you don't own it. The county says you didn't pay your taxes. We're going to confiscate it because you owe us $200. And this is roughly the value of your house. you own it because of someone else's permission. Bitcoin you own because you have the keys, and Bitcoin does not care about anybody's permission. It will work in happy, I don't care disregard to the big piece of paper with the signature on it. Because that is not the key. So because of that, like, that's why Michael Saylor and some of these very large hedge funds and stuff, because we know there's 21 million, we can verify that there's 21 million and the network has incredible integrity. Aside from using it as a currency in the future, which I think definitely is down the line, right now it provides ownership assurances that you can exchange it, you can move it, you own it everywhere in the world at once. You don't have to take it across a border. It exists in every single border on the planet. As long as you have an internet connection, you have your Bitcoin. So it's not like you have to leave the country with it and, you know, like put it into customs or whatever, and they check and count it and see how much it is. Like, no, you don't have to bring anything with you. Your Bitcoin exists everywhere. You can also move it on a banking holiday at midnight on Saturday in Istanbul or Russia or New Guinea. It doesn't matter. Wherever you are, like, Bitcoin, as long as you can get information to the Bitcoin network, Bitcoin's like, all right, we're good to go. We're in business. So because of that, just that right there, those are unbelievable assurances that nothing else can really give you.
But using your the cell phone or email analogy, you need somebody on the other side who's willing to take that asset that you have.
You need to be able to exchange it for goods at some point, or exchange it for yen or yuan or dollars. But there's a global, very liquid market for exactly that.
Okay.
Yes, like maybe you will have to, you know, maybe India outlaws it or something. You have to hop over the border and go to China to sell it. But nonetheless, you can offload it for something that will allow you to consume real resources in some form or fashion. That network is pretty broad, but the capacity to use it as a currency, like an everyday currency, not there yet. But the tools right now are being built. It's like TCP/IP in the early 90s, you know, HTML was just getting, like, the web, like, you know, like hypertext and the ability to go, like, click on a thing and just go to connect to a different server on the fly. That was absolutely groundbreaking. That turned computers and the internet from something that was like a black screen with a command line of code that you just, like, would give it, like, language instructions, like, go to this thing, to I can click, I can surf. It's an experience that has, like, you know, that has this interface that I'm just, like, flowing through this thing, surfing the web, right? Now, back in, like, 92, that idea was possible. We knew that eventually we could figure this out. There was going to be some really fascinating use cases for it. We knew that this was an independent communications protocol, and eventually we could have internet streaming, that we could have TV run over this thing, that we could have shopping in our living room. But we didn't know exactly how it was going to work. And certainly we couldn't do it on a dial-up connection. That's where we are right now in Bitcoin. All of these things are clearly possible. Like, for instance, like, from the currency standpoint, there's something called the Lightning Network, which is kind of like a HTML on top of TCP/IP. There's this additional layer on top of it that uses TCP/IP to communicate, but then adds all this extra functionality and makes it a whole lot faster. That is Lightning Network to Bitcoin. Like, for instance, I can send transactions in Bitcoin. Like, I can send hundreds of transactions without actually having to broadcast to the Bitcoin layer. It's a payment network on top of it that makes it so that we can actually get to the point where a billion people can use it at once, and we're not just flooding the whole system with just mountains and mountains of information.
And slowly more places are starting to take it, right? Like, I was in Vegas. Slowly,
yes. Yeah.
And there were casinos that were, like, now taking Bitcoin. When it comes to where to purchase Bitcoin now, there's a few different options that are out there. Like, one of them, I use Coinbase, and mm-hmm. I'd like to learn a little more about those type of exchanges. But then the other day I was at the gas station and I saw a Bitcoin ATM at the gas station. Right next to the where you put your change in, which I thought was kind of a weird placement for it. It's like, you can convert your change to dollars and then go right to Bitcoin or to Jewel gift cards, whatever you prefer. You know, you got your options on that thing. I'm like, I don't know the right way to buy Bitcoin, but I don't think it's that.
The ATMs usually charge a pretty high fee.
Okay.
So they're the convenience of having them like out in the wild. They usually, like, I think the one in my mall right nearby is like an 8% fee or something like that. Jeez. And I went, I bought like $30 on it one day just for fun.
Yeah.
Just to have said, yeah, I used an ATM. But Coinbase is long time business. So like I would say they're trustworthy. I don't trust them in kind of a grander scheme, but I trust them in the sense that they're not going to take my money and run away with it. Like they've been around for a long time. I've definitely used them quite a bit in the past. But they are probably, I don't send people to them specifically because they usually try to dump like a bunch of just dog shit tokens on people. And I think not thinking about this, like there's going to be a billion currencies and like there's going to be a special money for every potential use case is really just a way to be completely and utterly confused.
Sure.
And also to get wrecked, to lose a lot of money. Because I think the vast majority of these things are just tokens because somebody wanted to be able to write numbers into a spreadsheet and sell them for actual money. Well, sell them for actual Bitcoin because that's what they do with them. They dump them for Bitcoin. And 99.9% of them are going nowhere and they're not serious in any way. And they're just waiting to get their spike so that the founders can dump it and then watch it fall 99% while a whole bunch of people desperately cling to it and say, it's right around the corner. It's right around the corner for the next year while it just bleeds. So I like to stay away from those. Yes, it's penny stocks. It's penny stocks. It's exactly what it is. It's a big gamble. It's a big casino
of
tokens.
Okay.
So I try to steer away from that sort of stuff in general. Bitcoin itself is hard enough to understand. After you get a decent footing in Bitcoin, if you want to branch out, sure, have fun. But listen to Shitcoin Insider first. But with that, my favorite ways to buy Bitcoin personally that I all use. Swan Bitcoin, I am actually an advisor. I worked with that team for a short while, like while they were like really rolling out. But I had been desperately waiting for a service like this for a very long time. And it's just a way to auto buy Bitcoin is that I just buy $50 every week, no matter what the price is, no matter what it's doing. That is my savings account every single week. Monday, I buy $50, $50, $50.
Mm-hmm.
And I can up it whenever I want. And they're going to have like some one-time buys too. So that like, let's say the price dips like $3,000 or whatever, because it's, you know, volatile all over the place.
Of course.
Prime opportunity. Oh God, I can just run over to my Swan Bitcoin account and buy like $500 worth when it drops. And then I know I bought the dip, you know, quote unquote.
Yeah.
So Swan Bitcoin is a really good one because they also have really low fees. Cash App is one that's really convenient. Cause like I have a debit card that's stuck to my Cash App. Like that's how I usually keep like what's closest to my bank account, like in Bitcoin, because I'm as fully invested as you can get. Like Bitcoin is just my money. If I get money into the bank account, it's because it's there for a couple hours before I turn it into Bitcoin. and then I keep it in Bitcoin. And then if I have to use dollars, I'll sell roughly exactly what I need at the store while I'm standing in line. And then swipe my debit card from Cash App.
Really?
Yeah. So Cash App is a really good place to do that. But they do have a tendency to, you always have the risk of getting your account frozen. So I don't keep much in there. You know, I keep like what I need at any one time. And then the other two ways that you can actually do without even signing up with any like explicit Bitcoin service or doing like KYC or anything like that is Lolli. Is a plugin that gives you, sorry about that. You can hear
no
the
worries.
Dogs.
That's yeah. Okay.
Okay. Lolli, Lolli, is a plugin you can put on your browser. And if you just do like generic shopping, like at walmart.com, Target, like all these different places, you just get percent back. So it's basically like an affiliate share. So like you just start earning, like you go to shop at Walmart and make sure that your little Lolli thing is activated. And then they'll give you 1% back on whatever your purchase was. Like, so if you know, spend $200, you get $2 worth of Bitcoin and you just accumulate it in this account. So I always have that active. And then another great one is Fold. Fold app is, and you can do this again just with your debit card. So this is like normal stuff where you can just earn Bitcoin, is you buy gift cards at a discount and you get, again, get quote unquote sats back is what it's referred to as, but you get percent back in Bitcoin. So like with Amazon right now, I can get 2% back. So I do all my shopping. If I have to do it from dollars, I do all my shopping. I just buy Amazon gift card, fund the account, and then, you know, do my purchasing or whatever. And I've earned, I've gotten I guess right now I'm probably about like 2.2 million sats, which is like $400. And I've just earned that just by doing normal ass shopping, you know, buying Amazon. Like my car broke down. I went to AutoZone, just used AutoZone gift cards on Fold. I'm remodeling my closet. So I've spent about $600 on like plywood and stuff like that at Lowe's gift card through Fold. So those are great ways to do it without even having to quote unquote go buy Bitcoin. You just earn it by doing the stuff you're already doing.
So am I to understand, did I hear correctly? All of your money is Bitcoin?
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. Talk about putting your money where your mouth is.
All right. Yeah. Did you stop listening at that point? that was very early on in that answer. I feel like you're stuck on that piece.
I've been wanting to ask that question. So did I?
yeah, unless there's like a bill, like strictly like coming out of the bank account. In fact, I'm trying to, the cool thing about Fold is I'm in the beta right now. So it's not available to everyone yet, but they've just opened it so that you have a straight up bank account and routing number. And then there's another company that's actually just dropping called Level, LVL, with just, you know, no E's, like the games, the game spelling, level.co, that is a fully insured, like FDIC insured bank, just straight up bank where you can hold Bitcoin in the account and there's no trade fees. So you could just swap between Bitcoin and dollars on the fly. And that's actually like brand new. They're only available like 28 states, but they're adding more constantly. So they just landed in my lap. But through both of those, I'm actually trying to switch my mortgage and my bills and everything over to my Fold account right now. And I might open up one on Level when they come to North Carolina. They are not here yet. But yeah, I'm trying to do like legit. I mean, Bitcoin is a great investment because I think, you know, just like the internet in 1992, if I could buy a stock in the internet, I would be buying the crap out of it, you know, thinking of it as an investment. But just in general, I just like knowing that if anything goes wrong, I can withdraw. I own it. It's mine. I don't care if the government prints $6 trillion. You know what? Go ahead. It's not 6 trillion Bitcoin. Right, you know, you can't touch mine. I've divested from that nonsense. I'm just kind of standing on the outside looking at you. People are crazy.
Can I just comment on that? Because to some extent, you still need it. Like when you're doing
it for currency. Yeah.
When you're doing your shopping, do you like if you need milk, do you like wait till a day where where Bitcoin's up, so you're getting a sale price on milk? No, do you know what I'm saying? Though? Like because if there's a value that could have, you know, on major purchases, that could be a big difference, right?
Certainly. If the price falls, I definitely, because I'm so heavily invested, I am definitely more inclined to be like, where can I find dollars so I can put into Bitcoin? And if the price is going up, I'm like, okay, I'll do some shopping or something now. It absolutely changes my behavior a little bit in that way. But again, for general expenses and stuff, often I still just have the grocery bill sitting in dollars. So it's probably about half the income comes in and I'm moving it to Bitcoin. So I'll still just go get some milk.
Sure. It's okay. Weird.
And if Bitcoin, you know, Bitcoin is volatile and it does move quite a bit, but because I've been referred to as dollar cost averaging, I've been buying in for so long, like I'm just fully in profit at this point. So I don't really, you know, if it goes from 19,000 to 16,000, like I don't really care. It doesn't faze me at this point.
Yeah.
And if I have to go buy milk, if I just need milk, like I just go get milk.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. All right. Hey, we're having a great talk with Guy Swan. Learned a lot about Bitcoin. So here's what we're going to do. We're actually going to keep this going. So we're going to cut this up and do a two-part episode. So come back, join us again next week for part two of our interview with Guy Swan. How are you? Still with me?
I'm still here.
All right. Well, we'll see if that's the case next week. We'll be back to you from the People of Comedy Network podcast studios. This is What Do We Know?
All right, so this will close out part one of our chat with Jim and Hari. They're going to be releasing part two soon. And if you, again, if you want to check those guys out and their wildly entertaining episodes of the What Do We Know podcast, I set up a redirect at guyswan.com/WDWK. And a last thank you to our sponsors. We've got the Bitbox, the secure open source hardware wallet for your savings, the Hexa wallet to hold your keys with multiple accounts on your mobile device, and then Level.co, the no trading fee exchange, debit card, and full Bitcoin mobile banking suite. This is the whole stack of Bitcoin services that you need to hold your keys, secure your savings, and use Bitcoin every day. We are going to be getting into the just released Bitcoin Times Volume 3. There are just tons of great pieces in this one, and I am so jacked to get into it next week. I haven't gotten through them all yet, but they are wonderful so far. And one of those happens to be Parker Lewis's next piece, Bitcoin and the Great Definancialization. So you are not going to want to miss this one. So don't forget to subscribe, share this out with all of your drooling friends who are now bugging the shit out of you, asking what a key is and how and where they're going to buy Bitcoin. Send them here to Bitcoin Audible. I am Guy Swan, and until next time, take it easy, guys. This has been a 111 production, and you are listening to Bitcoin Audible on the Crypto Economy Network.